You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives.
Hi, everyone. This is Kate Navickas, your host for this week's episode. I'll be introducing a follow-up conversation that I had with Rebecca Dingo after the CCR Graduate Circle's podcast panel event on transnational feminism. Participants in the panel included Rebecca Dingo, Donna Olwen, Anna Hensley, Tim Doherty, and Eileen Schell. For more on the transnational feminist panel, check out This Rhetorical Life, Episode 7. In this episode, I talked with Rebecca Dingo about her 2012 book, Networked Arguments, Rhetoric, Transnational Feminism, and Public Policy Writing. In Networked Arguments, Rebecca Dingo enacts a feminist transnational rhetorical analysis of global policies and conferences that are about women's role in a global economy. Focusing on three rhetorical commonplaces, gender mainstreaming, fitness, and empowerment, Dingo extends traditional rhetorical analysis to account for how arguments shift rhetorically as they are networked. Our conversation begins by us discussing the differences between the three feminist transnational terms Dingo uses to explain exactly how rhetorics shift: transcoding, ideological trafficking, and interarticulation. As we talked about gender mainstreaming, the development of policies that are intended to promote gender equality and women's best interests, and women's empowerment, we discuss how transcoding, ideological trafficking, and interarticulation offer different, nuanced ways that these well-intending rhetorics shift and are distorted. I guess I'm interested in the three methods you kind of lay out: transcoding, ideological trafficking, and interarticulation, mm-hmm. precisely because I think that they're really useful rhetorical ideas that are an inroads for kind of doing transnational work.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, like, I'm interested in all of the different layers of the book, but I really see those as, like, challenging in a lot of ways some of the kind of traditional understandings we have of rhetoric and how it works.
Yeah.
So transcoding, which is in chapter 2 on gender mainstreaming, I kind of understand is how you describe it as literally originally meaning changing code to work on different platforms. Mm-hmm. And so you use it to think about how meanings get shifted based on context, occasion, and a word I can't see what I wrote. And then ideological trafficking in chapter 3 on fitness is kind of an attention to history and how concepts like the primitive colonial concepts have histories that, whether or not we're aware of them, inform every time we draw on those words or those rhetorics.
Yeah, they, like, bubble up.
Yeah, and then interarticulation is the one that I feel like then it's like I really don't know what I'm talking about anymore. I think it has to do with how shifting meaning happens with seemingly monolithic static terms as international policies travel.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm confused between interarticulation and transcoding.
And transcoding. I think that's a really good question. And I just want to say that I'm really happy that you noticed that about the book, because most of the times when I am talking about the book, everyone's speaking more specifically about the idea of the network of networking and how important that is. And it is very important. That's one of the key focuses. But I really wanted to... all of those terms come from transnational feminist work, and I really wanted to talk about how they work with our rhetorical methods, and so I really appreciate you recognizing that. And I'm trying to think about how to talk about the difference between transcoding and interarticulation. I mean, I think that the difference between the two of them, for me, was that transcoding is literally scrambling a meaning to work on a different platform, and the idea versus interarticulation, which is the idea that, and this is a very nuanced difference between the two, that a term can hold simultaneous meaning sort of at once. And so I'm thinking about, like, the notion of empowerment in, like, the Kiva microlending, that there is a purposeful shift, I think, to talk about empowering the first world lender there. But at the same time, they're drumming up this notion that women need to be empowered from the so-called third world. And so I think it's that moment of holding those two things in space at the same time versus transcoding, where you kind of literally see, like, I mean, and I think empowerment is transcoded as well. And I don't, perhaps I should have been a little more particular about that in that chapter, but I think that we see it being picked up and used in various different places. I saw it used in a makeup ad, you know, that having long lashes will empower you. But the difference between, I think, mainstreaming literally, where the idea there is this calling of women together to recognize and mainstream women's issues into the global economy, and then literally mainstreaming women through, you know, self-help groups, for example, or mainstreaming women. So it, like, it turned into this way, a very positive term, and then it shifted to a negative.
One thing I'm hearing that I don't know if I caught when I read it was that transcoding is a literal changing in the code, as mm-hmm. in, I mean, that sounds a little bit more awareness.
Yes.
Almost, yeah. As in, I'm using this for a different purpose, so it has to shift.
Uh-huh.
Whereas maybe inner articulation is maybe, while there are different meanings in every word, you're attempting to utilize the same meaning, but you don't.
Yes. I think that's a really good way to put it. Yeah. Okay. I think I should put like a little footnote in the book in the next versions of it, just to clarify.
Yeah, no, those are awesome, and I hope that people take those up, because I think that they are so useful, clearly useful for rhetoric. When you started laying your methods for this, so you already kind of said that in your dissertation you were thinking about policies on the local, mm-hmm. regional, state, nation mm-hmm. kind of level. I'm wondering if it's possible to describe some of the tangibleness of how you did that tracing or some of those observations. Like, did you think, okay, I'm going to start thinking about how neoliberalism works across all of these?
Well, I think that because all of the materials that I looked at came out of like the late 90s into the early 2000s, that, and I was very aware of this, you know, economic shift across the globe towards neoliberalism. So I had that in the back of my mind the entire time. And really, my dissertation probably is more of a focus on neoliberal rhetoric than it is on sort of transnational feminist analyses. And I'm trying to think, like, how I got to that place. I mean, I think that I'm lucky that because I looked at these local, national, and global policy, gave me a chance to sit back, you know, after a year, reread my dissertation, and start to be like, wait a minute, look at this, like, notion of fitness that is in all of these different documents, or in this ideology of what it means to be a neoliberal citizen, or, wow, every one of these policies is focusing on a person's personal responsibility, or their personal agency, or their own abilities. And I was like, there's something here that I need to talk about. I'm trying to think about how it was that I traced all the different World Bank policies. I mean, I think that, you know, I would read about one policy that I was looking at, and someone would refer to another policy, and so I'd look it up, and then I'd notice all these other policies at the same time. And so it was almost like this kind of domino effect to some extent, or you get on in the internet and you're reading a page and they have a link to something else, and so you link on that, and then you link on that, and then all of a sudden you have all this knowledge. And I think that oftentimes that's how that happened. And so I had this huge, you know, wealth of policy information. And when I kept seeing the patterns over and over and over again, I was like, I am onto something, and this is something that's really important that needs to be talked about.
What's the biggest challenges you faced using the methods, writing the book, doing this kind of work?
You know, I think that the biggest challenge has been trying to carve a conversation out in the field of rhetoric and composition to convince scholars in our field that they need to take up the transnational. I think that has been actually the biggest challenge. And I think that more and more, I notice with graduate students, for example, are picking it up, and so that makes me feel really good. But I think that's been sort of the biggest challenge of being worried that I was writing to an audience that didn't exist.
Do you still feel like that?
There are some days. I'm feeling less that way. But yeah, some days I feel that way.
I asked Rebecca about responses to networked arguments.
In the field of rhetoric and composition, we have historically always, I mean, if we think about you know, the good man with little quotes around man speaking well has always been this very localized event. When I was first presenting my work, you know, when I was a graduate student and then a new professor, I would frequently get critiques saying, well, I'm looking at these policies, but I haven't actually talked to the women and let them speak about their experiences with the policies. And that is true. I mean, but I'm not an ethnographer, and that's not the kind of work I'm doing, but I do think it's equally important to think about the way that language structures the material on a local level, and sometimes, and people's experiences of a policy, like, you know, you and I may be affected by Homeland Security policy, for example, but the way that we interpret it and the way it's affected our lives may be very, very different. And so I think it's dangerous oftentimes to boil it down to one certain person's, you know, experience.
I asked Rebecca about her understanding of the uptake of feminist work in rhetoric and composition, specifically whether or not she thought the field was supportive or resistant to feminist work, and what brought her to a feminist transnational project.
You were talking about how you think the field has been kind of resistant to feminist work, and that maybe that's part of the resistance to
yeah.
the slow pickup of transnational work.
Well, let me say this: I don't actually, just to shift that slightly, that I don't think that the field has been resistant to feminist work. It's the only one of the only ways I think that I can imagine that there has, and I wouldn't say it was like an active resistance, but maybe it's. Because I think the term feminism in front of anything assumes that it's just about women, even though we know a feminist lens is not just about women. It's about gender, it's about power, it's about geopolitical relationships, it's about race, it's about class, it's about ability, you know, ethnicity, all those things. But I sometimes wonder if it's easier to sort of overlook because of that term.
That's actually one of my questions, and it's because I do feminist composition, feminist uh-huh. pedagogy, and I'm really interested in rhetoric. I just don't have a rhetorical project yet.
Sure,
I'm hoping
sure.
someday that'll happen
yeah.
just magically.
Yeah.
But, so I guess I think that question comes up a lot in scholarship. So it's
mm-hmm.
not that I need to be reified, or, you know, like, it's not like I need you to explain to me why feminist work is awesome or why we need the
yeah.
feminist work, but I'm
yeah.
wondering if that's a question that comes up from people for you
mm-hmm.
a lot, like, why is it feminist? And Anna kind of talked in the panel a little
yeah.
bit about, like, the difference between content that's clearly feminist, and yours is kind of both, like,
mm-hmm.
methodologically feminist
mm-hmm.
without the content, but then also
mm-hmm.
you're looking at specific gendered issues that affect women.
Yes, yes. It's interesting because the Transnational Studies Reader, which is a collection of essays that sort of pulls together kind of a genealogy of the creation of transnational studies, which is still sort of, you know, pretty marginalized area of interdisciplinary studies. And, you know, for me, because I entered transnational studies from a feminist perspective, and when I look at the way that that book is put together and how they define transnationalism and transnational studies, which I can't get into, like, because they have, it's, you know, 15 pages of them really being specific about it. They draw so much from transnational feminist work. I mean, and feminist work in political economy. And so it's, for me, I can't imagine doing transnational studies without it, because I think partially because I'm schooled in women's and gender studies that everything has a gendered lens to it. I mean, it kind of, and I'm trained to look for that. So can you do transnational studies without transnational feminism? It's interesting. I was talking to a little bit with Krista Olson about this at the C's, and we were trying to put together a potential transnational feminist or transnational rhetorical SIG or transnational feminist SIG. We weren't sure what to talk about it. And Krista said, well, I don't really do the gender part of it or the feminist part of it. And I actually think she does, because I think that one of the things, so feminists are not, feminists are always concerned with issues of power and where power, who has power, who doesn't have power, where power is produced, how power can be productive. And I think that that's one of the key things that transnational study or that transnational feminist studies does, and why you don't necessarily have to have just a gendered lens. But if you're thinking about relations of power, then it is a transnational feminist project.
And I also think about Chandra Mahanty's call about genealogies mm-hmm. and academic genealogies, and I just think you're so right about placing that. It's coming out of women and gender studies.
Yeah.
I'm hesitant to say that because I don't really know.
But well, I mean, and that's one of the things that I think that I've realized in terms of, like, the turn towards thinking about, and I don't know if this was recorded before, the terms about thinking about, you know, the ecologies or thinking about networks, that to me, and I feel like that the transnational feminists have been talking about those kinds of things for a number of years, and so that's my entryway into it, as opposed to looking at Latour, for example, who is very important, but I think that it's just, I just have a different inroads, I think.
And I see feminists also as that coming out of intersectional work.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
We were talking about matrixes a long, long time ago.
Absolutely, and there's a really good article, and I think it is, it's by Inderpal Graywal and Karen Kaplan, about sort of the legacy of transnational feminist studies. I forget what the article's name is, but that's what they kind of talk about, how intersectionality is the kind of precursor to transnational studies. Absolutely.
Because that's really what got us thinking about, one, the differences in everybody and in groups, but then also, like, how material bodies are affected by place and space and policies and things like that. So, one of the things, I think that the word, I hadn't thought about the word feminism, and I think that that speaks mostly to my place at Syracuse.
Yeah.
I'm in this nice little liberal
haven
here.
Yeah.
But as a graduate student, I think about you, Eileen, and Wendy Hesford's work, and I think about, also, I feel this very much coming into the women and gender studies transnational work that you see happening. It is so responsible and so many layers that it's daunting. Like, I keep thinking about Jacqueline Jones Royster's Traces of a Stream, where she says, oh yeah, 17 years took me to do this book, you know, and I think about not so much being afraid of the commitment, but how do you start a lifelong career project like that and think about negotiating all those layers at once?
This is a question I actually get a lot, and it frequently comes particularly from my graduate students who are working on doing a transnational methodology, and they don't know where to stop. And I think that's a difficult question to answer, because I think for almost every project it's going to be different, which sounds, I know, realize sounds sort of wishy-washy, but eventually I feel like that once you have enough of the primary data, the analyses that you've made of your work, and you can start enough to be able to tell the story that pulls on all of these layers, then that's kind of where to stop. But I think that, you know, I look at my book, I probably could have written, you know, volumes and volumes and volumes. I think at one point I remember in writing it, I was like, I should just write a book on the rhetoric of empowerment. There's so much here, there's so much richness, you know, in this notion of empowerment. But I think that, though, putting it together with all of these other terms told a much wider story, I guess. And so I don't know if I've sort of answered your question, but I think that you're right, that, you know, I mean, one thing I think that happened when writing networking arguments and looking at the rhetoric of empowerment is that I realized that there are so many jumping off other projects that could be done, and then so it just spurs you on, I guess, to do more.
What's your advice to graduate students then who are starting this work? But I mean, see, I think that what happens is that you get interested in the scholarship you see, and you're not attached to particular materials or projects going on. You know, like Anna's talking about, oh, on my blog feed, because she's connected now.
Yeah.
She's at a point where in her project where she's already connected. I guess I'm interested in advice you might have for anybody in between those points. Like, I've read the scholarship and I want to enter these conversations, but how do you locate a project and materials
and
start connecting?
Yeah, you know, and Anna and I actually talked about this a little bit at the C's, that to some extent, I mean, what I look at is that you spend the point of coursework is you get this kind of archive of knowledge that you get to sort of put in the back of your head to pull out when you need it. And I would really suggest that, you know, if you have a particular project that you're working on, whether it's an analysis of a policy document, whether it's a teaching practice that you're working on in the classroom, whether, like, whatever the thing is that you're working on, is that you sit with that thing for a long time. And I actually really like like the writing analytically's idea of how before you start writing that you just make observations, because I think that when you sit with something and make the observations, that is where all of a sudden you start pulling the theory, pulling that archive, and you start seeing, okay, to really understand how to make the best practice of the messy composition classroom, as we talked about, like in the podcast event earlier, you know, in order to justify why this messy composition classroom is necessary, I can pull from X, Y, I can pull from all these different places. And that's where I think you can start to put the theoretical framing on the project. I mean, I think that as graduate students, it's really hard because you've got such a minute time to actually write, to get your project together and start writing it, and whether you're going to be in this lens or another lens. But oftentimes, if you can sit with the material for a longer period of time and just kind of be with it and then see how to go from there would be my advice. And it's not necessarily advice I admittedly took when I was a graduate student, because, you know, the way, at least in my graduate program, we had several fellowships to apply for and various kinds of leaves and whatnot. And so we were always asked to produce. And I think sometimes that made me produce before I was ready. And I think, and I say that by also recognizing the need to write always and early and often, but sometimes that writing's messy and you don't end up using it. But I think being in that practice of writing is always good.
As a feminist composition on that kind of side of the divide, mm-hmm. like obviously I see transnational work, and especially in feminists in the field, tending to be picked up in rhetoric, mm-hmm. right? And I guess I'm interested in, one, how you take this up in the classroom, and I know mm-hmm. we covered a little bit of that in the panel, but also how you could imagine it being picked up by feminist compositionists in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that composition to me is, one, teaching students how to be writers and responders, but I also think that part of what we do in the composition classroom is get them to be, I mean, I hate to use the word critical thinkers, but I think that's part of what we're trying to have them do, which is to, you know, wallow in the gray areas and take risks in not just their writing, but the kind of research that they do, the kind of materials they bring together. And so I actually think that, like, a transnational feminist method, because it's messy oftentimes and you're pulling in so many different vectors and ideas into one thing, it can be overwhelming. But I actually think it's a really good place to be in that moment of being overwhelmed. And so for me, when I am teaching students writing, what I ask them to do is to start, like, kind of peel away the layers of an onion. I mean, one of the things I talked about in the podcast event is seriously not taking things at face value, and what does that mean? And so getting them to move beyond their comfort zone of, like, just researching on Wikipedia, and instead, you know, actually getting into the nitty-gritty of archives, for example, or of even, like, contacting, oftentimes I use a lot of documentary films, and, like, taking the next step to try to contact the documentary filmmaker and see what he or she, you know, says, since they were on the ground and, you know, and exploring a particular kind of issue. And so I do think that it's a method that's fairly easily adaptable, and it's not just about teaching students about, you know, globalization or global issues, but how to think about global issues. And I don't mean that and telling them you have to think this way, but, like, the multiple layers and multiple ways that you could kind of come at an issue. And, you know, part of this comes from, I remember, you know, a long time ago when I was a graduate student, that, you know, talking with Nan Johnson and having sort of a disagreement with her, because, you know, she does a lot of work on historiography and rhetoric, and, you know, she would always say, well, you know, you're looking at the material results of discourse, but we know that there's a bullet in Gettysburg. And my kind of way of looking at it was like, well, yes, but, like, who shot the bullet or where it came from or the results of that bullet depends on, you know, who you are. Were you a Native American who was there and watching, you know, things happen? Were you an African American who was being forced to fight? Were you a woman who was there who was a nurse? Which side were you on? You know, were you up on the hill? Were you down below? Like, that, if you start thinking about all those different perspectives, that a story is going to look very, very different. And I think that that's one way it can be adaptable, you know, in the composition classroom, or even taking one issue and having students try to look at them from these different perspectives, and then putting those together makes it realize that you have a really rich sort of research and writing project then.
We also use writing analytically here. So I'm sure you know it's a very dense, difficult writing handbook. So thinking about the complexities of bringing this kind of feminist transnational approach into the classroom, I'm interested in the terms that you choose to use with students versus ones you just bring the concept into. Mm-hmm. So for instance, we often talk as graduate students about, like, some people use the evolving thesis and some people don't. I guess I wonder if there's any feminist or transnational concepts that you explicitly talk about and use because you find them useful terms, or if there's certain concepts you slide in without really giving them the terms for.
I think that when I teach writing, that oftentimes I probably put more emphasis on the gathering of materials before having the thesis. I mean, I will, at the end, we'll talk about an evolving thesis and whatnot, but to me, particularly in the 21st century after No Child Left Behind and whatnot, students aren't equipped to make good arguments. They know how to write a thesis, they know how to write, often, at least in Missouri, they know how to write a 5-paragraph essay, but they don't have any kind of way of getting outside that comfort zone and gathering lots of information. And so I talk a lot about peeling away the layers of the onion. I talk a lot about the notion of networking. And so, you know, taking an issue and starting to connect it to one thing to another. And so I had students who last semester, I taught a gender and globalization class, and this wasn't specifically a composition class, but we had an end of the semester project that was a writing project. It ended up being almost like a documentary podcast kind of thing, and they wanted to respond to Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudon's Half the Sky because they felt like there were a lot of holes in, one, in the arguments that they were making about women's oppression across the globe, but also in the way that the material was being presented. They never really came up with a focused thesis per se, but what they came to in their process of looking at all the different layers, whether it was the call for them to look at post-colonial relationships and neocolonial relationships, to looking at environmental issues, to looking at the way that women are represented in the book itself, but they really got to the term structural violence. And it was interesting to me to see that process and how that so much of that project ended up being about that process. And I think that that process was so rich and important. And I think, you know, when we have them in the composition classroom, we have them for like, what, 16 weeks? There's not a lot you can teach them in that time period, but you can start having them think beyond what they have already learned. And so I've been shying away more from those sort of static conventions, probably to the chagrin of professors across the university who are looking for the composition classes to be the gateway into teaching students how to write. But I actually think that they have to learn how to think before they can even sit down to start writing an evolving thesis, you know, because you can't have an evolving thesis until you recognize that an interesting paper and an interesting thesis is not just a statement, that it actually has a lot more layers to it.
I think feminist pedagogy, a circulating question that comes up again and again is, you know, the ideological question. Are you trying to indoctrinate your students to get them to see the point? And I feel like you hear very different articulations of that. So I guess I'm just curious about your reaction and ways of working with students who are really resistant to day one, like the topic of inquiry, say.
Yeah, you know, in Missouri, that actually has deep material effects around that because we are of an academic diversity statement that is state mandated called the Emily Brooker Bill, where a student sued her professor who she claimed made her write a letter to an organization that she didn't believe in. And so we have to be very careful about what we teach and how we teach. But anyway, so I don't believe in indoctrinating students with particular views, but I do believe in presenting students with methods of finding information so that they can start to put the story together. And that's what I really have found that I think that as a teacher I do really well, because I am a Half the Sky ambassador on my campus, which means that I have shown the film, I've talked about the film, I've taught the book, and I begin that oftentimes there because oftentimes students really love the material and they're moved by it. But by the end of the semester, you know, they recognize because of the histories that I've taught them, because of the ways of sort of research that I have taught them, that they really see the holes. I try really hard to say, okay, you know, I see that you have this perspective. I respect that perspective. And now here's what I want you. I want you to start peeling away the layers of the onion. So what else is going on here that's not, you know, not obvious? And oftentimes they get there themselves.
I know indoctrination, using that word, makes it sound bad. But right. In the back of my head, I'm always thinking of Jonathan Alexander, who always, in his book, says things like, yeah, I do want them to change their minds by the end of the semester.
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
No, right? we all do, yeah. But I think it hurts a lot less on them if they can do it themselves.
Yes.
Thank you to Rebecca Dingo for taking the time to talk with us. I'm Kate Novickis, and you've been listening to This Rhetorical Life.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.